So first of all, I'd like to welcome and thank you all for joining us today. My name is Nicole Drumhiller, and I'm the Program Director for Intelligence Studies at the American Public University System. My collaborators on this project include Dr. Mark Pythian and Dr. Ruben Arcos. On behalf of the School of Security and Global Studies at American Public University and American Military University, the School of History, Politics, and International Relations at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom, and at the Center of Intelligence Services and Democratic Systems at Rey Juan Carlos University in Spain, we'd like to welcome you all to the first session of the International Online Intelligence Hub, or as we like to call it, the Intel Hub. As leading providers of postgraduate intelligence education in our respective countries, our universities have sought to bring you a partnership with an outward-looking focus on internationalization and a commitment to maximizing the benefits that such an organization can bring back to its students and faculty. The Intel Hub is designed to be the leading international student forum for the exchange of ideas and perspectives relating to intelligence. Our goal is to bring together academics, practitioners, and students in a series of themed sessions that will promote the transfer of knowledge, exchange views and perspectives, and help enhance the internationalization of the student experience. Our first speaker for our speaker series is Dr. Jose Miguel Palacios. He was the head of the Analysis Division in the European Union Intelligence Analysis Center of the European External Action Service in Brussels. He joined the EU Situation Center in 2006 as an analyst, after having worked for the Spanish government since 1986 in several analytical roles. He's a visiting professor at the College of Europe in Bruges, Belgium, and will be speaking to us today on EU intelligence and the importance of international cooperation in intelligence. So for today, as you can see, we've set the room up in such a way so that we have a chat room area where you are able to type in your questions as they arrive. And then at the very end, we will open it up to questions. So that way, we will allow you to speak through your audio systems as well. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our speaker today, and we'll go from there.
Hello, Nicole, and thank you for your introduction. And hello, everybody. My name is Jose Miguel Palacios, and I'm speaking now from the Canary Island, a subtropical paradise that where it's still practically, we are still practically in the middle of the summer. So in this very favorable situation, I will try to share with you some ideas around the EU intelligence, what is EU intelligence, and how this experience of integration, of intelligence integration at the level of the European Union can be used probably, if not as an example, at least as a reference for other areas, for other regions of the world. So basically, that is what I would like to talk to you about in the course of the next 40 minutes. Why intelligence, national intelligence, maybe even in the biggest countries of the world, may be too small to face the challenges intelligence and security is having to face nowadays. And then, of course, some conceptual and terminological clarifications, because in practice, in life, very often, we do not understand each other because we don't share the same code of definitions of concepts. And that simply to lose a little bit of time with clarifications is always a good investment. Later, we will move to the definition of the EU intelligence clients. It's very often when people speak about the European Union is seen as something, as a single organization, as a single political actor. And in reality, as all of you having some experience in EU environment will probably know, the EU is a much more complex environment. And we need to distinguish carefully which are the political actors which are relevant there in the European Union and how they can be supported from the point of view of intelligence. Then we will move to listing the EU intelligence bodies and organizations currently existing. Finally, we will speak a little bit about the European intelligence community, and I will tell you already that those of you knowing, having some experience with the US intelligence community, if you expect to find in Europe something remotely similar to the very structured and very articulated American system, so you will be very disappointed, because what we have in Europe is based completely different principles, and the architecture is completely different. And finally, the key point from my point of view, some tentative lessons for the postmodern world, the world where we are living now. And then let's move ahead. Do you maybe remember this day, 9/11, so the terrible terrorist attacks of the 9/11, 2001? So if you remember the case, there were very, very nations which were in one way or another involved in the preparation and in the execution of those attacks. For instance, of course, the attacks took place in the United States, and terrorists have received some training in the United States, so the United States was there involved, but some of them were Saudi or Egyptian citizens. Some of them have lived recently, so a few years before the attacks in Germany. Some of the meetings for preparing the attacks took place in Spain. Part of the preparation of the attack took also place in Afghanistan. So that means that if somebody wanted to have the complete picture of the attacks, if somebody wanted to have early warning about the possibility of a big terrorist attack, actually, that was very, very difficult to be done on the basis of the resources of any national intelligence or security authority. Even those countries which have a really very powerful intelligence apparatus would have difficulties to receive all the information necessary, simply because in order to detect one such thing at a very early stage, it's necessary a capillarity that only intelligence organizations and law enforcement organizations with presence in the field, with some control of the territory, can offer. So that means that the 9/11 is the typical case that it was practically impossible to prevent with the sole resources of the national intelligence organization of a country, even if this country was as big and as powerful as the United States. Cooperation would have been necessary. Let's move ahead. That's 2015. Do you remember the one day in November when terrorists organized several attacks in bars, restaurants, just off the national soccer stadium in Saint-Denis? Then it's pretty much the same story. Most terrorists came originally from Morocco, but they were living in France or Belgium, and they were French and Belgian citizens. They had, many of them, some recent experience as foreign fighters in Syria. They have also received some attention from the security authorities in Hungary, Greece, Turkey. It's again the same story. Only one national jurisdiction was very insufficient to be able to receive all the information that would have helped to prevent these attacks in Paris to have been carried out. So we have spoken until now about terrorism, but pretty much the same can be said about many other recent modern transnational threats, cyber crimes, organized crime. In all those kind of threats, international organization is very, very needed in order to be able to have the necessary resources to prevent this kind of activities. Then this was my first point, which was not difficult to explain. I think that now all of us are deeply convinced that in the modern world, borders cannot be some kind of protective shield for criminals and terrorists. Borders is something that can should be dealt with, and international cooperation should help security organizations and intelligence organizations to deal with this kind of threats in a more effective way. Then let's move ahead and let's go to the first part of the presentation, to what I promised to give clarifications, some terminological and conceptual clarifications. The first one is about intelligence. We have been speaking about intelligence. Many people speak about intelligence, and actually they use the word intelligence in very many different senses. I would say that for me, for us, for the purposes of this presentation, for understanding how the EU intelligence system is working, we could accept, as Sherman Kent, the person you see in the screen, that intelligence is knowledge. It's knowledge produced, generated to support policy making. And that will be intelligence for us. Intelligence will be for us knowledge, knowledge in support of policy making. The next thing I would like to clarify is the relationship between intelligence and secrecy. Very often intelligence has been associated to secrecy, and it's a very natural association, given that part of the information which is interesting for us, which will help us to have the whole picture of the situation, is information which is not publicly available. It's information that has to be collected by secret, by special means. And so this association of intelligence and secrecy has a certain tradition. In some countries, for instance, intelligence is necessarily secret intelligence. Everything which is collected by other means is interesting, is useful, but it's not intelligence, properly speaking. I would say that for our purposes, we should be a little bit more open. Why? Simply because in reality, first, people with practitioners of secret, so-called secret intelligence, they acknowledge freely that a large proportion of the information that is possessed by intelligence organizations in order to produce the knowledge policy makers need is really open sources information. So why to pay to collect information that is available for free? That's very logical, and that is how things are in reality. The second thing is that for some particular kinds of intelligence, secretly collected information is vitally important. So maybe if you would like to know who about the plans for having a nuclear bomb in some country, so probably you can do very little on the basis of openly available information. You need to go a little bit further. But that is not the case all the time. In many cases, the information you need for some particular purposes is freely available. And you do not need to pay to collect the information you actually need. So actually, we also know that in the 21st century, with open sources, you can do a lot. And with open sources, quite often the results are splendid. So I would say that for this presentation, yes, we acknowledge the importance, we will acknowledge the importance of secretly collected information, but that is not everything. Intelligence cannot be only information collected by secret means. Quite often, in many cases, the information we need to build our analysis might eventually be open information, and that is not wrong in principle. Information, the origin of the information is not the most important thing. The most important thing is the quality of the information and how the information tackles the points that our lords and masters need. Third point would be about the association between intelligence and security. As you can see in the slide, many security agencies throughout the world have the word security in the official name, that's very logical. And why? Because in practice, intelligence is not all the knowledge might be categorized as intelligence. In practice, we talk about intelligence very often when we are producing knowledge which is relevant from the point of view of security. Scientific knowledge, for instance, it might be extremely important, and scientific knowledge is not intelligence. Intelligence must be something else. This intimate association between intelligence and security is something that, even if it's not officially acknowledged in many normative documents, it's something that it's sort of a consensus in the intelligence community. Intelligence people deal mostly with security threats. Of course, nowadays security is an ambiguous concept. Different people have different ideas about security. In the past, we could say that security was mostly internal security plus foreign security, and we could also say that foreign affairs were part of the security, defense was part of the security. Now some people would expand the concept of security in order to include environmental security, to include social security. All that, of course, it's there are good reasons for doing that. I would say that now, in 2017, intelligence, as we conceive it, is still very associated to the security, and that to the security in understood in classical terms. That means intelligence in support of such activities as internal security, defense, foreign affairs. Let's go ahead. And now the next conceptual point I would like to clarify was the question of the families of intelligence. When we speak about intelligence, we understand that intelligence is a single discipline. But in practice, those people which really have experience of practical experience in intelligence, they see that intelligence is practiced in rather different ways, in different organizations, different branches. And so we can distinguish different so-called intelligence families. On the left side of your slide, you can see what we could call the governmental intelligence. So intelligence which is produced in support of governmental clients. And then the classical division in internal security, foreign security, military security, which is really very important, and finally maybe technical security. On the right side, you find intelligence which is produced by private organizations for the benefit of private clients. And here we can basically speak about commercial intelligence, like also analytical using the slide. So commercial organizations that produce intelligence for a fee. And then we can also speak about competitive intelligence. Here in this presentation on EU intelligence, we will exclusively focus on governmental intelligence. So the intelligence produced for the benefit of the common bodies of the European Union. And we will completely exclude from our presentation everything which is, I would say, extremely important and very fascinating in this field of the private intelligence. And the next point that needs clarification is European Union. Quite often, we speak about Europe and European Union as if they were synonymous, and it's not, they are not. The Europe, of course, is larger than the European Union, but for practical purposes, I would say that in practice, we can identify the European Union with the EU for one reason, and that is that Europe nowadays, in the 21st century, is basically an integration process, a very ambitious and rather successful integration process, which is articulated around the European Union. And practically all European countries west of the former Soviet Union are part of this integrational process. Let's see that in the slides. Here you can see what the European Union nowadays, the 28 member states included Britain, which unfortunately is going to leave us in 18 months. But for the time being, we are still 28. This is the European Union now. But you can see here the European Economic Area. What is the difference? The European Economic Area, apart from the European Union, includes Norway, includes Iceland, includes Liechtenstein, a tiny country between Switzerland and Austria, and it doesn't include formally Switzerland, the white country you see in the middle of the map. It doesn't include Switzerland, but in reality, Switzerland has a series of bilateral agreements with the European Union, and in practice, Switzerland is almost as if it were a member of an associated member of the European Economic Area. What is the European Economic Area? European Economic Area means that countries belonging to the area have exactly the same rights as the European Union, but they do not belong to the organization. In practical terms, it means that they can sell freely their products in the European market. The citizens have complete freedom of movement and freedom of work in the European countries. They even contribute to the European budget. The only thing is that, given that they are also the law, the acquis from the European Union, the common law of the European Union fully applies to those countries, but given that they are not officially members of the Union, they do not sit around the table and they do not participate in decision making. But for practical purposes, they also, the situation of the European Union is not very different. And the third map is the customs union. So countries which do not enjoy, citizens do not enjoy freedom of movement in the European area, but their products have an unrestricted access to the European market. That's the case of Turkey. Then you see some countries in white in the Balkans. They are not members of the European Union so far, but all of them are candidate or potential candidate members. So in sooner or later, in probably in less than 10, 15 years, all of them will be part of the European family. So that means that in practical terms, Europe, in one configuration or another, and all this Europe organized around the European Union and the EU institution, comprises the whole of the continent west of the former Soviet Union. In some ways, this part of even some integrational processes are affecting particular countries of the former Soviet Union, such as the Transcaucasian countries, Moldova, or Ukraine. Well, that was what I wanted to explain as preliminary conceptual clarifications. And let's move to the main point of the presentation, and that is to define the EU intelligence clients. First of all, I think it's crystal clear to all of us that intelligence is produced in support to policy making. So in a way, the structure of the intelligence organizations reproduces the structure of the decision making process. And in this sense, we have to take into account the European Union is not simply an organization separated from member countries. In the European Union, you will see all the time member states and common institutions cooperating, member states and common institutions sharing responsibility, taking part in complex decision-making processes. So that means that that will also reflect in the intelligence apparatus that has been set up to support this process. This intelligence apparatus will have a common component and will have components in member states. And then let's see in this slide the EU institutions currently existing. I said in the introduction that the European Union is quite often presented as a single organization. As a matter of fact, it's a rather complex set of organizations. And some of them are more, some of them are less connected, less with policy making, insecurity related issues, in which are basically two: common foreign and security policy, that's one of them, and the home internal security, that's the second branch. And so some of the institutions you see here in the slides are really very involved in these processes, some others are less. Those very involved will be supported by intelligence, some less involved will be less supported. Here you will see marked in red the four main blocks of institutions which really need intelligence support. First of them is the European Council. The European Council, which is composed by heads of states and heads of government, is the supreme decision-making body in the European Union. If we compare that with America, that could be maybe the equivalent to the president, to the figure of the president. That's the top decision-making body. And in particular, questions related to security are mostly in the hands of the European Council. That's something that is decided by European Council and by unanimity of the member states. Under the European Council, you have the Councils of Ministers. There are several configurations: Councils of Ministers sit ministers of all member countries in one given branch. There is, for instance, one Council of Ministers of Foreign Affairs. There could be a Council of Ministers for other departments. And that at a lower level, it's exactly the same at the highest decision-making bodies. Both of them need to be supported by intelligence. Why? Because they are the main decision-making bodies in the field of common foreign and security policy, in the field of internal security. At the bottom of the slide, you will see the European Union External Action Service, the EEAS. EEAS is some sort of Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the European Union. And given that, in practice, the implementation of the common foreign and security policy, but also the development of proposals in the field of common foreign and security policy for the European Council to approve, are in the hands of the European External Action Service. So that means that they also need a lot of support in the field of the EEF, in the field of intelligence. Then we have two other blocks of bodies, which are in an oval, in ovals in red color. One of those is the European Commission. The European Commission is sort of a government, but only in those fields which are in the, according to the treaties, are the, in the competence of the European Union, the common competence of the European Union. For instance, trade. In trade, the foreign trade is not a competence of the national authorities, that's a competence of the European Union. So there we have that the European Union, the European Commission is fully sovereign, and the European Commission, under the supreme authority of the Council and subject to the control of the Parliament, is practically like a government. In other areas, like for instance home affairs, where the main responsibility lies with the European Council, with member states, so that means then the role of the European Commission is only a supporting role. So that means that here, in some DGs of the European Commission, they need some intelligence support, simply because they participate in some way in decision-making processes with a security aspect. Even areas which in principle could not be security related, for instance energy, we have a DG for energy in the European Union. At the end of the day, we know that energy is one of the big main components of modern strategy. And so actually every time we speak about energy, energy resources, energy providers, we are speaking also about strategy that has a clear security aspect. And of course, in this area, the Commission needs to receive some support from intelligence. And we finally have agencies. Agencies are implementing organizations which enjoy some administrative autonomy. So that means that a typical agency would be Frontex for the protection of the external borders of the European Union. So agencies, some of the agents really really need intelligence support. Even in some cases, they can produce intelligence by their own means. A typical case would be Frontex, but there are also other energies, other agencies which need support from intelligence. Eurojust, which is the agency for supporting justice cooperation, Europol, which is the agency for supporting police cooperation. All of them need some support from intelligence. Then, simply, before going to the next slide, simply to remind a couple of really important point. And the important point is that, yes, we have clients, European clients, but here those clients are, in some cases, are clients purely EU, like the European Commission, and in many other cases are clients where mostly member states representatives sit and are those taking the decisions, like the European Council. So this case that in even in the decision-making process, member states and common institutions are all involved, all participate, and all can be clients of their own right, is very important to have in mind, simply because that will reflect in the way intelligence is organized, intelligence is practiced. And then let's move ahead to the next slide. And the next slide would be simply to introduce to you the EU intelligence bodies really existing. So those bodies in the European Union which are really specialized in producing intelligence. One first remark on them. The first is that in the European construction nowadays, there is a principle of subsidiarity. So that means that it's done at the European level, only that which is better, more effectively done at the European level. Otherwise, it's done at a lower level, at the national level. In intelligence, we will see that it's done at EU level, what is better to do at EU level, and all the rest is it's done at national level. And then the second thing that you will see is that together behind those common bodies, there are always plenty of national intelligence organizations which are interacting with them, which are supporting them. Then you have the three specific intelligence bodies that we have in the European Union. The first one of them is the EUINTSEN. EUINTSEN is the is the civilian intelligence analysis directorate, which belongs to the EEAS. It's a very small organization. I've read somewhere that in the United States, INR, the intelligence agency of the State Department, is very small. So having only 300 analysts, so EUINTSEN is much smaller, it has around 50 analysts. So that's only, it's a really small organization, and it doesn't have any collection capability of its own. So it works on the basis of information received from member states, secret information quite often, on the diplomatic information produced by the European Union. The European Union has one of the biggest diplomatic networks in the world, with 140 embassies and a good number of civilian and military crisis management missions and operations. So that's also a very important source of information. And finally, of course, the open sources, which are used by everybody nowadays. The right side, you have the Intelligence Directorate of the EUMS, European Union Military Service, military staff. It's the typical intelligence directorate of a military organization, smaller than its civilian counterpart, and it works mostly on the basis of information received from military intelligence services from EU member states, and also information received from missions, from crisis management missions. And the third specific intelligence body would be SATSEN, the Satellite Center. Satellite center doesn't process its own satellites. The satellite center simply processes satellite imagery, which is in many cases, in most cases, is commercial, and in some cases is received from the satellite owned by some member states. Those are the three specific intelligence bodies existing in the EU, and you will see here other bodies with intelligence functions. Europol. The main role of Europol is to favor, to encourage, to stimulate, and to facilitate in cooperation between the law enforcement agencies of the European Union. But it's clear that one important factor in the cooperation is to have access to the same set of data. And so the exchange of information of interest for from the point of view of law enforcement is an important part of Europol activity, and that is why we have included Europol in this slide. Frontex. Frontex is the agency for the protection of the external borders of the European Union, and it's clear if you want to protect the external borders, you need to know a lot about smugglers, about the routes, about different organizations which are of interest for understanding the phenomenon. And also, with your analysis, you contribute to the situational awareness of the European Council, on the Council of the European Union at different levels. And in this way, you also contribute, you are also producing intelligence of interest for the European Union. And finally, the third point, the third vertex in this slide would be the European Union Institute for Security Studies. That is officially sort of a think tank for the European Union, but in reality, if intelligence is knowledge, knowledge is understanding, and understanding is sense-making. So it's clear that the Institute for Security Studies has a role in helping decision makers in the European Union to make sense of different situations. They produce some papers openly, and those papers are accessible in the website of this institute. But they also work on the request of EU bodies, and they can produce, and they do produce sometimes, studies papers for European institutions in case of necessity. So those are the bodies that really, from my point of view, are relevant from the point of view of intelligence in the European Union, common bodies. And now the question would be how... Yes?
I'm sorry, I just wanted to say, it looks like that there was a question in the chat where an individual asked what the difference was between Europol and Interpol, if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes, thank you. Difference. Yes, really, I'm not really a big expert in law enforcement. My basically, the initial idea is something very similar, but at the level of the European Union, given that the cohesion of the European Union is much higher than the cohesion of the international community. So that means that the exchange of information is always based on mutual trust. And yes, that means that the intensity of exchanges at the level of Europol is higher than the intensity of exchanges at the level of Europol. But basically the same, the idea, the original idea is very similar. The idea is to bring together representatives of the police of different countries and make them exchange information and cooperate in the measure of the possibility. The biggest difference is the intensity, and the intensity of the cooperation is a product of the great level of mutual trust existing between EU member states. Hmm. Then let's move ahead, and if we move ahead, I would say that we need now to find ways of connecting the dots. We know until now that there are different bodies which are purely European. We also know that among the clients we have a purely European common bodies, and also member states having a role in decision making. And we also suspect that apart from the common intelligence bodies, we will also need We will also need some kind of participation of member states, intelligence security organization. And so I think, unlike the United States, where we have a very structured intelligence community, what we can see in the European Union is a much less structured intelligence network, a network of networks with very different systems and subsystems with variable geometry. And let's see exactly what I mean by that. The first issue, we have at least five components. The first component is those components which are linked to the European Union. So that means intelligence or coordination structures existing at the level of the European institutions. Here we have only one which is really important. That's the so-called SIAC. SIAC is the Single Intelligence Analysis Capacity. It's an arrangement which was set up by former High Representative Javier Solana 10 years ago, and it's an umbrella organization for the civilian and military intelligence of the EAS, which have to work together and under this common roof, with the idea of bringing together all the best information available in order to be able to produce the best possible analysis. That's the only coordination structure that we can find at this level, at the level of EU institution. But we will find more if we go to the next vertex. The next vertex is EU institutions plus member states. The EU institutions plus member states, which is really important, because if EU institutions do not have collection capabilities of their own, so that means that the information has to be collected by others, by member states. And we need some coordination structures for in some way coordinating the interaction between national and common components of the intelligence process. And here we have two institutions which are important. One of them is the yearly conference of directors of civilian military and civilian intelligence services, which usually takes place in the spring. And we have a similar thing for the military, which takes place in the autumn. In the case of the military, organizations tend to be more structured than civilian ones. And so in the case of the military conference, they have also even a written arrangement, written agreement, defining carefully the rights and obligations of each of the parts. In the case of the civilian organizations, it's more flexible. There is no written guideline, but actually there is a forum when they meet together, they can explain the situation and they can request help from one for another. The third point would be member states without EU institutions. In some cases, it might be shocking, but it's true that in some cases, the member states cooperate between them without EU institutions being there at all. Why? Mostly, the reason is of historical nature, because in some cases, we have institutions that existed already, or networks that existed already before the EU equivalents were set up, and actually, you know that the world of intelligence is very practical, it's very pragmatic, and they have found no reason for dismounting the system. Then the best known of those coordinating bodies is the so-called CTG, the Counter-Terrorist Group. The Counter-Terrorist Group gathers all the security counter-terrorist organizations of all member states, plus Norway and Switzerland. So they sit together. In principle, there are no formal obligations, but they sit together, they exchange information, they learn to cooperate, they know each other, and really it's informal to a certain extent, but it's been very effective and has been very effective for years. So we can even say that once Britain leaves the European Union, so, of course, Britain will not be represented in the common institutions, but, for instance, Britain will continue having a very important role in the CTG. And that means that, in one way or another, Britain will continue being associated to this intelligence complex of the European Union. So the four component is the member states with external partners. That means of course, if we said in the beginning that no single country can face alone all the threats, all contemporary threats, that's pretty much the same also with the European Union. The European Union is bigger than any of the member states, but at the end of the day, there are 500 million people. It has limited resources, and they need to cooperate. So some very important components of European security are not in the hands of the European Union. For instance, defense. Defense is in the hands of NATO. So cooperation in the frame of NATO is part also of this European network. It's also a very important part of this European network is the network of bilateral relations between the United States and different, in particular, European countries. Of course, this is a network centered in the United States, but it's also cooperating to the common task of securing European security. And finally, we have a series of regional clubs. You can find in the intelligence literature information about them, but in some cases, some intelligence services of Europe have set up clubs with countries, with intelligence services of particular regions, with different purposes. But they also contribute, even if they are not connected directly to the EU, they also contribute to the common security. Finally, I would say that there are other networks. Other networks means that networks which are based on completely different principles. You have probably heard about Global Futures Forum. That's a network where not only intelligence agencies are represented, but also academics, also private intelligence practitioners of competitive intelligence, private intelligence practitioners. So that's important also because by putting together intelligence practitioners from different families, they contribute to the improvement of the professional skills of all, and they also contribute to the improvement of the protection intelligence can bring to the European Union and to the member countries. And finally, the Internet. The Internet is open to everybody, but thanks to the Internet, plenty of intelligence analysts around the world are having access to very interesting developments in the field of intelligence training by universities, by practitioners from around the world, and they, thanks to that, they can improve their professional level. Then, it's getting very near the end, and then let's go to the lessons for the rest of the world. And yes, I think that our world is structured in the form of a network, of a complicated network of networks, and it's not a hierarchical, it's a network like the Internet, and this network structure of the EU intelligence can be probably a source of inspiration for all of us, simply to think that at global level many things can be organized in a similar way. I would say that, of course, the EU organization is the EU intelligence setup is based on the fact that there is an EU organization, and it's in large part is supported by the internet institutional architecture of the European Union. So that means that without this institutional architecture, many of the things that we have seen could not be possible. But others could. Others could. For instance, what could be possible from my point of view? I think that for the principle of informality could be possible and could be applicable everywhere. For instance, the idea that we do not really need a rigid structure, rigid agreements. We are living in a world of networks, and informal arrangements, network arrangements, can be more practical than more rigid arrangements as they existed in the past. The second thing is the subsidiarity. Don't expect from a higher level to solve the problems that you should solve at your own level. So don't set up transnational structures if you can sort things out at national level. So that's also something very important that we have learned in Europe, and I think it also has a certain value at global level. And finally, some challenges which I think could be rather specific of the global world of the moment where we live. The first one is that everything that we have shown has worked very well in the West and has worked well in parts of the world which are under strong Western influence. But the fact is that the West is not alone in the world, that there are other actors, and some actors are so important as China, Russia, and India. So that means that, okay, we can be rival at times, but there are also plenty of shared interests with them. So in a way, and that would be to go beyond what we have been able to achieve at EU level, we should be ready to be able to cooperate more efficiently, not only with our friends, not only with our partners, but also with those which very often can be seen by us as our rivals, simply because despite being our rivals, we shared a lot of common interest, and by associating them to the protection of those things which are very basic for all of us, the protection will be more effective. And so that is basically, I think it's already my Cinderella time, so I would finish here. And then I would be very happy to continue discussing with you any topic of your interest related to the EU intelligence, or to listen anything you would like to comment on that. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. So I want to go back to some of the questions that arose in the chat, one of which was specific to how does the International Criminal Court interface with European Union intelligence organizations. Is that through Interpol?
No idea. Actually, criminal intelligence is not really my specialty. My specialty is foreign intelligence, and the European External Action Service, we were not part of that. So I couldn't tell you. Basically, one thing that is really interesting to know in order to understand how EU intelligence works is that given that practically everything which is produced by EU common bodies is produced on the basis of information, secret information received from member states, that means that European Union is not sovereign to communicate any piece of intelligence to third parties without the permission of the originating member state. So that means that if the EES would like to sign an agreement with the ICJ on forwarding EU intelligence, that would not be possible, simply because the member states have a veto right on all information originated on intelligence supplied by them. That's one point. The second point is that for criminal intelligence, basically what they really, or for criminal purposes, what they really want is they want raw intelligence. They do not really want analysis. They do not really want knowledge that could be built on the basis of data. They want raw intelligence that can be used as evidence. These kind of things are simply not in the hands of common EU bodies. So this kind of information is collected by member states, and it's the property of member states, and member states are those that supply this kind of information to international organizations as the Criminal Court.
Okay, and here's another question from the chat. With the economic challenges facing the EU at this time, will this impact EU intelligence organizations, meaning with Britain trying to exit the financial turmoil in Greece and etc., is there a chance of fracture in the system?
I wouldn't say so, simply because the system, and I go back to the question of the Pentagon, the network of networks. Yes, Britain, for instance, will not have representatives in the common bodies in a couple of years, but Britain will still be part of the CTG and will continue sharing with other European countries a lot of security information there in CTG. And Britain will still be part of NATO, and through NATO they will continue sharing. So that means that this is a rather flexible network. It's like the internet. Even if one node is neutralized, there are plenty of alternative opportunities. So I think the great advantage of this organization is that it can work in different ways depending on circumstances, and that the informal part has a lot of weight. So that means that even if such things as the ones you mentioned really occur, there are alternatives. Of course, you always pay a price, but I think that European intelligence will continue working more or less at the same level.
Okay. And here's another question. Do EU intelligence organizations maintain relationships with universities across Europe, similar to the Center of Excellence idea that takes place in the United States?
Yes and no. Yes and no. First, to say what are the EU intelligence organizations. I mean, from the EU intelligence system, from this Pentagon, I would say that the common institutions are only a tiny part of this system. So plenty of what is being done is being done at the national level. And here the differences between countries are really, really very important. But there is a certain tendency to play by the same rules. A friend of mine told me 1 week ago that, for instance, 15 years ago, analysts coming to Brussels from member states, in general, have not been trained in structured analytical techniques. And now that mostly all young analysts coming to Brussels from many different countries, most of them have been trained in structured analytical techniques and have been trained according to the same standards. So that means that the main part of the system is in the hands of member states. Member states have different policies in this field. In which concerns the common bodies, yes, there is something, but simply you have to have in mind the small size of those bodies, and so the limited possibilities. Particularly the military branch, the intelligence, EUMS intelligence, has less freedom of maneuver, but EUINTSEN has had for 5-6 years an academic outreach program, and as part of this outreach program, part of the training to EUINTSEN analysts is provided by one British university. So yes, there is something even also at the central level, at the level of the common bodies, but simply we need to have in mind that the size is really very, very limited, and that EUINTSEN is a very small organization, and all the rest of the intelligence bodies are even smaller.
Perfect. And it looks like we have one more. What are the main sources of confidential information, and do European Union intelligence bodies have the ability to process and store the confidential information received from member states?
Yes. They do have the necessary means, practically like everybody. They have a secret network to store and to process this information. And the main source of classified information they process, the main source are member states' intelligence, civilian and military organizations. Most of the classified information comes from them. There is a lot of classified information, but of lower level, produced by EU embassies around the world. And depending on the country, it might be really, really very interesting. And really, one of the advantages is that the EU embassies are really very, very big. And that means plenty of people deployed on the field. and they can often produce really interesting information. And finally, the third source of classified information is the information produced by mission and operations deployed in countries at risk. So in most cases, this is information of low level of classification, but it's also part of the cocktail.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. I wanted to see if my collaborators, Ruben or Mark, had any additional questions that they'd like to ask or any comments that they'd like to make at this point in time. Hope I didn't catch you too off guard. Oh, I can see that Ruben is typing. Yes, many thanks to our speaker today for presenting, and thank you all to all of our attendants today. I wanted to remind everyone that our next session is going to be on December 13th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and during that session we're going to be unveiling our authors series, where we will bring in a recently published author that will talk about their recent publication, and we'll give some tips on research, and we'll go ahead and move forward with that in December. But thank you all for coming so much. Jose Miguel, it was a pleasure to have you as our first speaker, and I look forward to seeing you all in the future as the Intel Hub develops and moves forward.
Thank you very much, Nicole, and it was a real pleasure. Thank you all.